Welcome to the Deep Dive. We're here to unpack complex topics, give you insights you can actually use. And today, today we're tackling something really crucial. It literally affects us all, you know, and it's pretty startling when you hear it, but heart disease, it's the number one killer in America.
It really is. And that statistic, that's exactly why in the medical field, any sign, any hint of cardiac compromise is treated as a major emergency. Time is absolutely critical.
Absolutely. So for this deep dive, we're going deeper than just the headlines. We've got a pre-hospital emergency care guide here, and we're focusing right in on cardiovascular emergencies. Our goal today, basically to give you a solid understanding of, you know, how our circulatory system actually works, what happens when things go wrong, and maybe most importantly, how first responders spot these situations and what they do about it.
Mm-hmm. And there's some surprising nuances in there, things that aren't always obvious.
Exactly. Think of this as like a shortcut to understanding those details that could genuinely save a life, whether it's just for your own knowledge, maybe professional readiness, or, you know, just being better prepared if you witness an emergency.
It's not just about what happens, but why it's happening and why those specific actions are taken.
Right. Why it matters. Wow. So to really get a grip on the emergencies, we kind of have to start with the basics, the machinery itself. Let's unpack the circulatory system. It's honestly, it's an incredible piece of engineering, isn't it?
It truly is. When you break it down, you've got three main players, the heart, the blood vessels, and the blood itself.
Big three. And the heart, wow, it has an amazing property, automaticity.
That's right, automaticity. It means the heart muscle can generate its own electrical impulses. It doesn't need the brain to tell it, beat now, beat now. It has these internal pacemaker sites, like the SA node, the AV node.
Like its own little drummer keeping rhythm.
Exactly. Now, the nervous system, you know, the sympathetic and parasympathetic systems, they can influence the rate, speed it up, slow it down.
Sure, like when you get scared or when you relax.
Precisely. But the basic beat comes from within. And that left ventricle, that's the real workhorse, pumping blood out to the entire body.
But if it has to work too hard? Against too much pressure for too long.
Yeah, that's where you run into trouble.
Yeah.
Like chronic high blood pressure puts a huge strain on it. Over time, that can lead to heart failure, fluid backing up into the lungs. Serious stuff.
Okay, so the heart's the pump. What about the pipes? The blood vessels?
Right, the network. Arteries taking blood away, veins bringing it back, tiny capillaries in between for exchange. It's this huge, intricate system.
But there's a specific set that's super critical for the heart itself, right? The coronary arteries.
Yes, absolutely critical. Think of them as the heart's own personal fuel lines. They supply the heart muscle itself with oxygenated blood.
And if those get blocked?
That's the core problem in most heart attacks. An occlusion, a blockage in a coronary artery starves that part of the heart muscle of oxygen.
And that leads to?
Damage. Heart muscle starts to die. That's a heart attack or myocardial infarction. It can also cause heart failure or trigger those dangerous abnormal heart rhythms.
Okay, pump, pipes, another fluid, the blood, you mentioned clotting earlier.
Blood has platelets, tiny cell fragments, and their job is to clump together and form clots to stop bleeding, which is great if you cut yourself.
But not so great inside a coronary artery.
Exactly. If you have plaque buildup in an artery and that plaque becomes unstable, platelets can stick to it and form a thrombus, a clot. And that clot can suddenly block the artery.
So how does that plaque get there in the first place? It's not just there.
No, definitely not. It's a process called atherosclerosis. And what's fascinating, or maybe scary, is that it's really an inflammatory disease. It's not just passive buildup.
Inflammatory? How so?
Well, it starts when the inner lining of the artery, the endothelium, gets damaged. Think smoking, high blood pressure, diabetes, high cholesterol. Those are major culprits. That damage allows fatty streaks to form. Over time, those develop into fibrous plaque. It kind of hardens, narrows the artery.
Like rust in a pipe.
Sort of, yeah. And it damages the vessel wall further. But the real danger zone is when that plaque ruptures or ulcerates.
Oh, okay.
That rupture surface. That's what attracts the platelets. They rush in, stick together, form that clot, the thrombus, and boom, you can get a near total or total blockage.
Which cuts off the oxygen supply downstream.
Precisely. Leading to ischemia and infarction.
So we have this complex system, electrical and plumbing, basically. How do doctors or paramedics actually see what's going on electrically?
That's the ECG, or electrocardiogram. It's a visual trace of the heart's electrical activity. You see the different waves representing different parts of the heartbeat.
Like reading the heart's electrical signature.
Exactly. And if there is a lack of oxygen, hypoxia, or if the conduction system itself is damaged, that electrical pattern goes haywire.
Haywire how?
You can get uncoordinated beats, like PVCs, premature ventricular contractions, or worse, rapid, ineffective rhythms like ventricular tachycardia, or completely chaotic electrical activity like ventricular fibrillation. VFib is lethal if not corrected immediately.
Which is why getting that ECG quickly is so important in the field.
Absolutely. A 12-lead ECG gives paramedics a detailed picture, and they can transmit it ahead to the hospital. It helps doctors prepare. Understanding these basics, you know, the pump, the pipes, the electricity, it really helps you appreciate just how complex cardiac emergencies are.
Okay, so that's the groundwork. Now let's get into when things really start to fail. Cardiac compromise and acute coronary syndrome, ACS. Those are the big terms, right?
They are. Cardiac compromise is kind of the catch-all term for any heart-related problem causing inadequate function.
Gotcha.
And atherosclerosis, that inflammatory process we talked about,
yeah.
When it specifically affects the coronary arteries, we call that coronary artery disease, or PAD.
Makes sense.
Now, acute coronary syndrome, ACS, that's an umbrella term too. It covers conditions where blood supply to the heart muscle is suddenly blocked or severely reduced. Think unstable angina and actual heart attacks, myocardial infarction. Both stem from narrowed arteries causing myocardial ischemia, that lack of oxygen to the heart muscle.
Let's talk about angina first. Angina pectoris, that's the classic chest pain or discomfort, right?
Usually, yes. It's typically brought on by exertion or stress when the heart needs more oxygen than the narrowed arteries can supply. The key thing about stable angina is that it usually goes away with rest or nitroglycerin.
But then there's unstable angina. How's that different?
That's a major red flag. Unstable angina means the discomfort is lasting longer, it's getting worse, or, and this is crucial, it happens without any specific trigger, like even at rest.
So resting doesn't help, or it happens out of the blue.
Right. That suggests the plaque might be unstable, maybe a clot is forming or dissolving intermittently. It's much closer to an actual heart attack.
Which brings us to the acute myocardial infarction, AMI. The heart attack itself.
Yeah. That's typically when a plaque ruptures, a clot forms, and it completely blocks blood flow in a coronary artery.
And you said time is critical here.
Unbelievably critical. Within about 20 to 30 minutes, that's it, of inadequate blood flow, heart muscle cells start to die. They don't regenerate.
20 to 30 minutes. Wow.
That's why treatments like clot-busting drugs or procedures like angioplasty need to happen fast. The goal is to restore perfusion, get that blood flowing again, before too much muscle is permanently damaged. Time is muscle, as we say.
Okay, this is vital. But you mentioned earlier that not everyone gets that classic chest pain, right?
No.
The atypical presentations.
Oh, absolutely. This is so important for everyone to know. Women, people with diabetes, and the elderly often have very different symptoms. They might not have chest pain at all.
So what do they experience?
For women, it could be like a neck ache or pressure between the shoulder blades, pain in the back, the jaw, arms, even the upper abdomen, sometimes just tingling fingers or extreme unexplained fatigue, maybe trouble sleeping.
Things you might easily dismiss.
Easily. And for diabetics, especially those with nerve damage or the elderly, they might just feel short of breath, nauseous, lightheaded, or profoundly weak.
Wow. So the takeaway is?
The takeaway is huge. Treat any unexplained concerning chest discomfort or these other atypical symptoms, especially in these groups, as a potential cardiac emergency until proven otherwise. Don't wait. Call for help.
Better safe than sorry. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Now, are there other things that can feel like a heart attack but are actually different emergencies?
Yes. Definitely. And they need different immediate management. Two big ones are aortic aneurysm and aortic dissection. These involve the aorta, that main artery leaving the heart.
Okay, what's an aneurysm?
An aneurysm is a weak spot in the aortic wall that bulges out, kind of like a bubble on a tire. If it ruptures, it causes massive internal bleeding, often fatal very quickly.
Where does the pain usually show up?
Often in the abdomen, back, or groin. And here's a tricky part. It's frequently mistaken for kidney stones because of the location and severity of the pain.
Oh, wow. Okay, and dissection.
Aortic dissection is different. That's when there's a tear in the inner layer of the aorta. Blood surges through the tear and starts separating the layers of the artery wall.
That sounds incredibly dangerous.
It is. It often happens in the chest section of the aorta. The classic description is a sudden, severe, sharp, tearing or ripping pain, often felt in the back, between the shoulder blades, or radiating to the flank or arm.
Tearing or ripping, that's a key descriptor.
Yes, And the critical point for first responders, and even in the ER initially, is distinguishing these from a heart attack. Because while you give aspirin for a heart attack,
you absolutely should not give it for an aortic emergency.
Correct. Aspirin thins the blood, which would make the bleeding from an aneurysm rupture or a dissection catastrophic. These conditions need immediate surgical repair, not blood thinners.
So again, that careful assessment, listening to the type of pain, considering these other possibilities, it's crucial.
It's paramount, especially yeah. Recognizing the atypical heart attack signs and the aortic emergencies. Knowing this stuff, it truly makes a difference.
Okay, let's shift then. We know the problems. We know some of the tricky presentations. Let's talk about the interventions. What do first responders actually do? Let's start with nitroglycerin.
Right. Nitro is a cornerstone for suspected cardiac chest pain. It's a vasodilator.
Meaning it widens blood vessels.
Exactly. It widens coronary arteries, improving blood flow to the heart muscle. And it also widens other vessels in the body, which reduces the amount of blood returning to the heart, lessening its workload.
Sounds like a win-win. But you mentioned rules.
Oh, yeah. Strict rules. You can't just give it to everyone. The patient's systolic blood pressure needs to be high enough, usually over 90 or 100 millimillar HG, depending on the protocol. And critically,
yes,
you absolutely cannot give it if the patient has recently taken an erectile dysfunction medication like Viagra, Cialis, Levitra within the last 24 to 48 hours.
Why is that?
Because those drugs are also vasodilators. Combining them with nitroglycerin can cause a sudden, severe, potentially fatal drop in blood pressure. It's a major contraindication we always ask about.
Good to know. Any other restrictions?
Yeah. Heart rate, too. Generally, shouldn't be given if the heart rate is very low, like below 50 or very high, over 100 or 120, again, depending on local protocols.
Okay. And if it's safe to give, how much?
Typically, one tablet or one spray under the tongue. If the pain isn't relieved and the blood pressure stays okay, it can often be repeated every 3 to 5 minutes, up to a total of 3 doses, while reassessing constantly.
Got it. Careful, rule-based administration. Now, what about oxygen? You hinted earlier that the old give everyone oxygen approach has changed.
Massively changed. Yeah, this is one of the biggest shifts in recent years, based on evidence. For a long time, we gave high-flow oxygen to pretty much every suspected heart attack patient.
Seems logical, right? Heart starved of oxygen, give it more oxygen.
It seemed logical. But research showed that in patients who weren't actually hypoxic, meaning their oxygen levels weren't low, giving too much oxygen could actually be harmful.
Harmful.
It relates to something called reperfusion injury. When blood flow, and thus oxygen, returns to tissue that's been ischemic, oxygen starved, it can paradoxically cause a burst of damaging molecules called free radicals. Excess oxygen seems to worsen this effect, potentially increasing the amount of heart muscle damage.
Wow. So less can be more in this case.
Precisely. So the current guidelines, like the 2020 AHA guidelines, are much more specific. We only give supplemental oxygen if the patient's oxygen saturation, the PO2 level measured with a pulse oximeter, is below 90%.
Below 90. Okay.
Or if they don't have an oximeter reading but are clearly short of breath, dyspneic, showing signs of low oxygen, hypoxemia, or signs of heart failure.
And if their oxygen level is 90% or higher and they're not struggling to breathe or showing those other signs.
Then for an acute coronary syndrome patient, we generally do not administer oxygen. It's about targeting the oxygen therapy only to those who demonstrably need it.
That's a really significant change in practice.
Yeah.
Fascinating. And it highlights how medical care evolves with evidence. What about those special patient populations we touched on earlier? Geriatrics, for instance. Anything specific in their immediate care?
Yeah, a few key things with older adults. We already mentioned the atypical pain presentation, especially in diabetics due to nerve damage. They might just present with breathing problems, nausea, dizziness. Yeah. You have to have a high index of suspicion.
Right.
Also, if an elderly patient has suffered trauma, like a fall, even if it seems minor, you have to think about potential cardiac involvement. They have less reserve, and trauma can sometimes trigger a cardiac event, or they might deteriorate faster. They can go into cardiac arrest quickly and sometimes don't respond as well to interventions.
Okay, that's important context.
And for those with pre-existing lung conditions like COPD or severe asthma, if they have a bad flare-up, the resulting low oxygen and acidosis can actually precipitate cardiac arrest. So managing their breathing is indirectly managing their cardiac risk, too.
In kids. You said cardiac arrest in pediatrics is usually different.
Yeah, very different cause usually. It's rarely the atherosclerosis and clot formation like in adults, unless they have specific congenital heart problems. In most kids, cardiac arrest is secondary to respiratory failure or airway blockage. Fix the breathing problem, and you might prevent or reverse the cardiac arrest. The focus is heavily on airway and breathing.
Good distinction. Now, one more specific group: patients with ventricular assist devices, VADs. These are becoming more common.
They are. VADs are mechanical pumps that help a weakened ventricle, usually the left ventricle, pump blood. They're often a bridge to transplant or long-term therapy.
So how does that change things in an emergency assessment?
Here's the really counterintuitive part. Many VADs provide continuous flow, not a pulsing flow, like a natural heartbeat, which
Ooh,
means
impulse.
exactly. The patient might be awake, talking, seem perfectly fine, but you likely won't be able to feel a radial or carotid pulse. Don't panic.
Okay, so how do you know if they're getting enough blood flow?
You assess perfusion differently. Look at their mental status. Are they alert and oriented? Check their skin. Is it warm, dry, good color? Look at capillary refill. Listen for the VAD's hum. You assess the patient, not just the pulse number.
And definitely don't mess with the device itself.
Absolutely not. Don't try to change settings. EMTs are trained to manage the patient, support breathing, do CPR if needed. Protocols vary slightly for VADs, often involving contacting their VAD center, but not to adjust the device itself. It's specialized equipment.
These nuances, oxygen use, VAD assessment, they're not minor details, are they? They're critical for providing the right care.
They are the difference between standard procedure and truly informed, potentially life-saving care tailored to the situation and the patient.
All right, let's put this all together. Imagine the scene. Paramedics arrive. What's the assessment process look like for suspected cardiac compromise? What are they looking for?
They're running through a mental checklist based on signs and symptoms. Obviously, chest discomfort is key pain, pressure, tightness, aching. And where it radiates maybe to the jaw, neck, arms, back, or even the upper abdomen, the epigastric area.
Okay.
But also that sudden onset of sweating, diaphoresis, often with cool, pale skin, that's a classic sign. Difficulty breathing, shortness of breath, feeling lightheaded or dizzy.
What about the patient's demeanor?
That can be a big clue, too. Anxiety, irritability, sometimes a profound sense of restlessness, or even this described feeling of impending doom. Patients just know something is terribly wrong.
Wow. Okay.
Then checking the pulse, is it irregular, too fast, too slow? Asking about nausea or vomiting. It's a constellation of symptoms.
Are there specific time frames or triggers that make them say, okay, this is definitely cardiac?
Yeah, protocols often have specific criteria. For example, if someone's known angina lasts longer than, say, 20 minutes, or if it's new angina that's getting progressively worse,
Yeah.
angina that wakes them up at night, nocturnal angina.
That sounds serious.
It is. Or angina that isn't relieved by rest or by taking their prescribed nitroglycerin, usually up to 3 doses over 10, 15 minutes. Or any chest discomfort that just hangs around for more than 5 or 10 minutes after they've rested. These all raise the suspicion significantly.
And you mentioned patients might downplay things.
So frequently, denial is common.
Mm.
Or they might attribute it to indigestion or muscle strain. That's why responders need to maintain the high index of suspicion, even if the patient is saying, oh, it's probably nothing.
So they suspect cardiac compromise. What's the immediate game plan? The protocol.
First things first, basic care. Position the patient comfortably, often semi-sitting up if they're having trouble breathing. Provide reassurance that emotional support is actually important.
Okay.
Then the interventions, following those rules we discussed. Oxygen, if indicated by low SpO2 or respiratory distress, based on the latest guidelines.
Right, the less is more approach if they don't need it.
Exactly. Assisting with nitroglycerin if their blood pressure is adequate and there are no contraindications like ED drug use.
Checking that BP first.
Always. And administering aspirin, usually chewable, typically 160 to 325 milligrams, again, per local protocol, assuming no allergies or active bleeding issues, and not if they suspect an aortic dissection.
Got it. Aspirin helps prevent the clot from getting bigger.
Correct. And a really crucial step is calling for backup if needed, specifically advanced life support, ALS, if the initial crew isn't already ALS, and initiating transport promptly. Time is muscle.
And getting that 12-lead ECG.
Absolutely. Acquire it early, transmit it to the hospital if possible. That gives the ER team a heads up and can activate the cardiac cath lab even before the patient arrives.
It all fits into a bigger picture, doesn't it?
It really does. These pre-hospital steps are the critical first links in the chain of survival for cardiac events. Early recognition, early access to help, early CPR if needed, early defibrillation, early advanced care. What happens before the hospital doors sets the stage for everything that follows. It's a coordinated effort.
Let's make this concrete with our case study. Bart Frey, 62, history of angina. He calls 911. What were his specific symptoms again?
Right. Mr. Frey reported a heavy pressure in the center of his chest, radiating to his left shoulder. Started 20 minutes ago while he was on a stationary bike.
Okay, exertional onset.
Yes, but critically, it wasn't relieved by stopping exercise or by taking one of his own nitroglycerin tablets. He also felt sweaty, diaphoretic.
And he said it felt different this time.
Yeah, he rated the discomfort a 7 out of 10 and said it felt worse than his usual angina episodes. His vitals were stable initially. Pulse 80, BP 13284, respiration 16, SpO2 99%.
Okay, SpO2 is good, so no immediate need for oxygen based on the new guidelines.
Correct. EMTs Ella Bray and Lisa Mullins recognized the seriousness. Since his SpO2 was fine and he wasn't in distress, they held off on oxygen. Lisa got the stretcher ready while Ella assessed him further.
What did they do next?
His blood pressure was well above the threshold, and he hadn't taken ED drugs. So Ella assisted him with a second dose of nitroglycerin from their supply. And per protocol, they gave him 325 milligrams of chewable aspirin.
Good. Nitro and aspirin on board. Then transport.
Yep. Prompt transport. En route, they reassessed. His BP dropped slightly to 12880, still stable. But his pain was still there, maybe a 4 out of 10.
Still having pain, BP.
Exactly. So he was eligible for another dose of nitroglycerin. Ella administered the third dose, kept monitoring him, got the 12-lead ECG transmitting, and gave the hospital a radio report.
So what was the final diagnosis at the hospital?
Just as suspected, he was diagnosed with an acute myocardial infarction, an AMI, a heart attack. Because they got him there quickly and the ECG confirmed it, he was able to receive fibrinolytic medication, those clot busters, very rapidly.
Perfect example of the system working. Early recognition, appropriate pre-hospital treatment based on protocols and assessment, rapid transport leading to definitive hospital care.
Exactly. That pre-hospital care directly enabled the critical hospital intervention he needed, likely saving significant heart muscle.
It really drives home how vital those initial actions are.
Yep.
Okay, as we wrap up this deep dive, let's just quickly hit the main takeaways again.
Sure. Cardiovascular disease is a huge health issue, number one killer. Cardiac emergencies can present in many ways, not just classic chest pain, especially in women, diabetics, and the elderly.
And time is absolutely critical. For acute coronary syndrome, every minute counts in terms of saving heart muscle. Time is muscle.
Right. And first responders use key interventions like oxygen, but only when needed, nitroglycerin with careful checks, and aspirin, all guided by specific protocols and patient assessment.
Plus, being aware of those other conditions like aortic dissection is vital.
Definitely.
So here's a final thought to leave you with. We've talked about all these atypical symptoms, the critical time window, the nuances of care like oxygen use. If more people in the general public understood these things, how might that change how we as a community recognize and react to potential cardiac emergencies?
That's a powerful question. Increased awareness could mean earlier calls for help, better information given to dispatchers, maybe even more bystander CPR.
And on a personal level, what steps can you, our listener, take to be more prepared? Knowing the signs, knowing your risk factors, maybe taking a CPR class. Understand that sometimes subtle symptoms need urgent attention.
Food for thought. Being informed is the first step.
Absolutely. Well, that's all the time we have for this deep dive. Thanks for joining us.